On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, Justine Hamilton and I interview Belle Hahn. Belle is a very interesting woman. She's had a lot of trauma that she's had to overcome in the course of her life, and she speaks very eloquently and intelligently about her journey through dealing with post-traumatic stress and what it's taken for her to get to a place where she is living a very productive, really interesting life devoted to the care of others. So hope you enjoy this podcast. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Hi, everyone. It's Justine Hamilton and Dr. Dana Saperstein. We've got an incredible guest with us today. It's her very first podcast, many more to come. It's Belle Hahn. And when I think of Belle, I think of sort of a color wheel because she does a lot of work with the chakras in her own healing work. And her life was pretty colorful with extravagance and living places and resources and opportunities. But at the same time, the other side of the color wheel, there was some darkness and some black and some gray. She had some trauma and some abuse growing up in her life. She had two very incredible parents that got divorced, and she was sort of in the middle of that. And she has found her way through her own healing work from, as she says, victim to creator. And we're going to talk about her life. We're going to talk about her time in a treatment center and basically an intervention from her friends and family where she went and was diagnosed bipolar, what that feels like. And she also, that was sort of the pivotal moment that I think is spurning her work to what she wants to do to help others out there in the mental health awareness. So I'm super grateful to have Belle with us. She's a very vulnerable person, and that's what this podcast is about. So thank you so much for joining us. And let's just start off. Can you tell me a little bit about you?
Justine, thank you so much for the beautiful introduction. And I'm so grateful to be with you both. Thank you so much for having me. And it is an honor that this is my first podcast, but that I've been wanting to talk about, the trauma connected to my early childhood for a long time. And I'm happy just to launch into it if you're ready.
I have one question before I forget it. Have you always been this vulnerable?
That's a really beautiful question. I feel like, from my own birth story, at least the way I've been, was told my birth story, which I talk about as the third chakra kind of coming into the world in this powerful way, almost born in a taxi cab, full force, full on, mm-hmm. right away.
In a taxi cab?
I didn't, my mother, wow. Somehow we made it right in the nick of time, but I was born at 7:34 and I think the taxi arrived at the hospital at 7:20 something. And it was just a race to she'd been, in labor all night before, and talks about her 16 ears of corn that she ate on the cob and this wild ride just even in labor. And so I feel like everything started vulnerably and powerfully, in a very full force way. But I was a really quiet, soft child, I feel like, even though I was powerful and intense. I wrote a lot of poetry. I wrote a lot of songs to the flowers. I was vulnerable to spirit coming in. Mm-hmm. And so I remember those moments in nature, and I remember being vulnerable.
How young?
In that way.
How young do you remember doing these sorts of things? What age did it start for you?
I wrote a poem called Silence is the Sound of Peace when I was three.
And 3 years old?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I had already been abused by the, I mean, in terms of vulnerability, it's starting at 18 months. So my nanny abused me. That was my first experience with sexual abuse. And she was also, it was also physical.
As an 18 month old?
As an 18 month old.
Do you have memories of it clearly?
I have memories of the memories coming back and overwhelming my nervous system in a big way. I have specific memories of the things I told my parents that, you know, my mother instantly was like, this can't not be true because she can't make this up at three. And then I went into art therapy pretty early on. So it was around three that I was in New York with a phenomenal therapist who did art therapy, some music therapy, and telling stories, very much children's play. And so around that time, I was both between New York City, which we were across the street from Central Park, and also Pound Ridge. So my memories of like singing to the flowers or writing poems to them was more in the country. And mom's like one rule was you can pick any flower as long as you know her name. So I learned about, you know, being in the vitality of being in nature, especially in such a bustling city and with so much noise and stimulation, and like to be in the refuge of nature was like, it's just extraordinarily vital for me early on.
Okay.
So that was, I feel like I've been vulnerable in a soft place with nature, but also I guess speaking my truth as early as I could, even though saying no was not really an option for me because it was connected. My, one of the memories is that, you know, anytime I would say no around two, I would like, I couldn't do it. I just would break down.
You couldn't say no. What do you mean?
So like I couldn't say no so much, just to explain, like in any given day, if someone's like, would you like a glass of water, and I didn't want a glass of water, I couldn't say no. So in school and preschool, I'm not sure I love this model now, but they use this idea of like, my mother always delivered a lunch to me in the mornings. I mean, she would come for breakfast to this preschool and bring a lunch. And they said, I want you to bring sticks this time to see if she'll eat the sticks or say no to them. And I could not say no. That's when, you know, more therapies started to come in because I just would freeze.
That's incredibly remarkable because the main vocabulary of a 2 or 3 year old is no.
Exactly.
Right? So that's just so stunning that
I'd freeze. Like, yeah. I literally couldn't. I mean, what I do remember is that when I'd say it, I would be hurt worse. So if you speak your truth, that's a no, and I didn't feel in my body like she could touch it, then, and I didn't say no, I mean, I couldn't say no. I tried.
Right.
So that was a lot of my teenage years were about unfreezing my voice because I think I carried that. I mean, I still am working through processing that, which is why this is so healing.
Right. You first got some help at three. What was your life? What was your life like moving forward from that early age?
I mean, what was cool about the art therapy is that we would discover more and more details about what had happened.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'll just give you one example that there was a bell, I was Isabel at the time, but a ringing bell had been buried in the mud and it couldn't be released out of the mud. And this like imaginary dragon would come and like take it out and up out of the mud and rescue it. And years later, I had like an imaginary dragon that would come named Melissa that would come and take me away whenever I would sort of just need to get away from things. I would run on the beach with this dragon. So I remember that these imagery, and it was also interesting because a lot of the art imagery was Disney and very like fantasy, and like there was the witch from Snow White that would swallow the baby, and then, you know, when the parents would go out for dinner, and then would like throw it back up and when the parents came back. So like really interesting specific visual imagery at that early age, and these pieces were all around my room. Like I grew up really processing. I guess that was my first real, like my job was to start processing this abuse. And then we lived in New York until about, I think right across the street from Central Park, the Met, you know, in this, right underneath Art Garfunkel's apartment, you know, I knew him very well, would sing to us when we were little. Like, it was this glamorous life surrounded by the most beautiful paintings, that my father was this incredible art dealer. And my mother, this very eccentric, spiritual, beautiful warrior woman. And my refuge was always like this escape to country or to the 3-block radius that was New York City, until my mother had a dream at seven. I was seven, and she had this like, we have to move to Montecito. And she thought it was in Africa. And that was her vision of this lost land that we were returning home to. And
wait a second, she thought Montecito was in Africa?
Her dream, literally her words to my dad was like, darling, we're moving to Africa. Wow. Montecito, Africa.
So wow. Funny.
And it was interesting because it was, we moved ultimately down the street from Lotus Land, which has all these plants from around the world. And the house my sister lives in now, when she first sat on the bench, she was like, this was my vision. Like, this was it.
Wow.
So she was always a visionary and saw things, and he, you know, went along with it, and we moved to Montecito, Santa Barbara, found that it was here in California, right by a different form of Africa, I guess, but quite beautiful and magical and wild in its own way. And at that time, more wild because, again, Lotus Land, where we moved by, wasn't even open to the public. And we had so much love of nature and the flowers and the garden and more expression. And, but then at six, or I guess we moved, I was five, because I remember very vividly, it was my, oh, that's right, seven was the divorce. I think we moved to five, and my sister was three, to Santa Barbara, Montecito. And then they were getting divorced at seven, but in the meantime, I experienced another abuse, and that was at age six.
And who was it that abused you then?
He was a stranger. I mean, I actually remember the face. That's the like fascinating part. I still, because I had to like describe it for the police report later. But he walked in to, I was practicing for lines on a chalkboard by myself. It was actually a dry erase board, but it was at the Peanut Gallery at the time. The Santa Barbara had this theater group called the Peanut Gallery, and I was obsessed, and I wanted to be an actress, and I was like, loved theater. And I was like rehearsing these lines and drawing on the dry erase board. And this stranger came in off of a bike saying that he was hurt and that he needed help. And then he locked the door. Cause I went to go, I was like, great, let me go get you help. What do you need? I need help. And I said, I'll go get you ice. I'll take care of you. And he said, yes, you'll take care of me, you know? And then
left. And then you called the police.
Well, he locked the door.
Right.
I went through it.
Right.
And then, and I'll share whatever you want me to share, but I'll just say that yes, after he left, I didn't call the police. I freaked out. I went home, and then we called the police.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was interesting because it was like this, there's no question in anywhere in my body that it happened.
Right.
There's no question in anywhere in my memory or my mind or my heart that it happened. But at that time, I remember trying to convince myself that maybe it didn't, because people were like, you just want attention. You just want people like love you already. And now
people
you're
were
getting
saying that to you?
The kids in the class. Because I got on stage and I made this announcement very bravely a few days later that was like, this happened on this campus.
And you were seven,
I
eight?
I was six.
You were six.
I was six. And I was playing a sea urchin in The Little Mermaid. And I was like on stage and, you know, but ready for my stardom then, ready to be a star, except wanting to be Ariel, wanting to do it, and then just completely shutting down again. And then when I got on stage, they're like, you want attention. This didn't happen. Filed a police report.
Your parents believed you.
My mother did. I'm not saying that my dad didn't, but I think he just couldn't imagine me in that much pain and how anyone could do that to me. And so it was a little bit of like, did this happen? You know, denial, survival. Mm-hmm. He was surviving and I totally respect where he was, you know, now. I completely understand as a parent, like what that would have felt like to have that information just overwhelm you. And, you know, just unprocessed trauma too. Mm-hmm. So it was really intense. And that was age six. And then about a year later, they got divorced. My grandmother died and we moved to the South. And that's my mother's mother, while she was dying, said, "Those girls need roots in clay, not shale. Bring them home." And so we moved to Augusta, Georgia, and had really interesting Southern exposure because my mother's entire side of the family is, you know, these Southern aunts and like a different world there. Very, again, surrounded by gardens and surrounded by nature and doing these construction projects. But we had the house in New York, two houses now in Santa Barbara because my mom got one when hot in Cold Springs, and then the South. So we were a trifecta of these, you know, poles kind
and
of.
How were you dealing with all of that when that was happening once you went to the South and it hadn't been that much prior that you were assaulted for the second time?
I mean, I continued therapy and therapies. There was a lot of support early on, which I acknowledge that I had this privilege that I could go see people when I, different therapists. We had an amazing one in Santa Barbara. The South was a bit more, honestly, got a bit more about religion because we went to Episcopal school and it kind of like guided us in a different form of therapy. And I would say I was pretty spiritual, but I identified it then as religious because I didn't, but I had like a Buddha in my room and I was always into like lighting candles and incense and just, and my mother did it and I kind of just followed her lead and, but I felt shame about it because I was in this like Christian school that like, you shall have no other God before me. And I was like, oh God, please forgive me. I'm lighting incense and praying to the Buddha, you know?
How long did you live in the South?
I mean, that's the thing. It's all very foggy because we were back and forth.
Oh, okay.
But we, by age 12, somehow through all of this, I had had another assault, and I had been living in kind of between New York, California, and the South. And that's when I said to my mother, went to go pick up a dog in North Carolina on a farm in this town called Tryon. And she went to pick up this dog and was like, this energy's calling, this land is calling us. And I was like, oh God, not again. And I got that to this property and I was just like, Tara, like it felt to me like Scarlett O'Hara dropped to the earth and was like, this is it. Like, I want to grow my own food. I want to, at 12, I was very in, we had animals. We had so many dogs and horses and we rode. And I think that really saved me because back to nature, but it was like, it really grounded me. And we were between different schools too. So we would like fly in and go, we were scattered. We were all over the place.
How did that feel?
I mean, now I've gone through a lot of anger when I was processing it later in my life that I felt so unsettled and so unstable. Felt then like what I knew, but also confusing. And I would say by age 12, like right before we moved to the South, there was another trauma in the family, which was my sister had been, I told you this, I think before, but my sister had been run over by this horse. Maybe I missed that at our previous moment chatting, but she was run over by this horse at this festival and we thought she was going to die and she was 10. And that's when we started like these incredible modalities such as acupuncture and cupping, Eastern medicine that I didn't know about. But at the same time that was going on, I was diagnosed as depressed. And I, around 11, so before we moved to the South, I, you know, started my period early. I ended up needing birth control for that because my cycles were so irregular and I was in the fetal position and they were like, you need to take an antidepressant. So I started.
This is a psychiatrist. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you feel depressed?
Oh yeah. I was curled in a ball crying because I also had bullying in school. One girl said to me, you can't be rich, pretty, and nice. Like, you can't be all of that. And I was like, what? What do you mean? Like, let's just be friends and come hang out at my house and or I'll go to yours. I didn't want to be lonely, yeah. You know? And
I'm a little confused. You got assaulted in New York or in the South? As a 12-year-old,
that was in New York. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail around it, but okay. I'm just going to say that there was a lot of vulnerability around that, you know, obviously, and a lot of mistrust and a lot of fear and a lot of, but it's kind of lumped together. You know, it feels like it was like I was in New York, but I was living in the South on a farm, mm-hmm. but I was like dealing with my sister having been run over in California. So all these parts were kind of everywhere.
For such a sensitive person, you really went through it as a child. I mean, that's a lot to unpack.
A lot, yeah.
So were you able to tell your mom again what happened
yeah.
to you? So
oh,
none
yeah.
of this, you kept,
none of
it
was
kept secret.
Secret. I had there an amazing therapist here at the time that was supporting me. But again, you know, I was on the antidepressant. I was having major tummy stuff. I feel like that's the gut brain. Like I was just... I was living outside of my body, surviving. Like
at 11.
I was,
at
a, yeah. Well, before then.
Before then, yeah.
Before then, and I also, when you say what was that like for you, I just keep getting these like hits where I just remember waking up in the middle of the night and go looking around the room and being like, "Where am I? Which side of the bed is the bathroom? Mm-hmm. Which house am I in?
Yeah.
Which life am I living?
Yeah.
What role am I playing?"
Yeah.
Not that I knew all those things that. At that moment, but I look at it now and go, wow, yeah, she was a very scared, confused little girl who was living in survival. And I wore all these baggy things to protect and to hide me. And I was mm-hmm. going to start, that's just started the whole hiding from your own body. And then the thing with my sisters was, it was like such a vulnerable time because I had always been the one I felt like being abused. And now that really, I think, set my depression off because it was like, oh my God, I just can't control anything. Like, even my sister isn't safe out on a field in school. Like, it's right. not a family member. It's not a whatever. It's not a, you know, a person that
a horse.
Lives at your house. It's a horse. And it's a, you know, people at a school that had been bullying me. And I came anyway. And she thought I had died across the field. And we both just were, you know, I'd later, you know, she can share her own story, but we were both just living in trauma survival.
Yeah.
Where was your dad during all of this?
Who was what?
Your father. Where was your dad during all of this?
So he was stayed in Santa Barbara.
Did you have a connection with him at all?
He was my best friend.
He was.
Best friend. And like my greatest, I mean, he was truly my greatest love at the time. I idealized him and I would fly back every summer when I wasn't in school in a back and forth way. I would fly pretty much 12 onward just by myself to come spend summers with him, take him to the music academy, which is a big nostalgic place for us. But his legacy in Santa Barbara is really that, the music academy. So I would take him there. We take him to Pilates, take him to dinners, take him to events. We were as close as it could get, but, you know, it was just very stressed too, to navigate the divorced relationship too.
Did you ever understand why they got a divorce?
I definitely understand it according to my mother.
Oh, okay. So she filled you in big time.
She filled me in and he gave me his, you know, they both had their opinions, and their stories. And I'd love for you to ask her that question. And I'm happy to answer anything, but it's.
Did you feel like the parent during a lot
yes,
of that time?
100%. I felt like the parent for the whole family.
Yeah. That's another.
And financially, like managing their relationship financially.
Yeah.
And my trip, like being, having wealth, but not having access and still being a child and still being like, It was very, it was a lot. It was a lot to hold.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
And then you start, you get a little bit older, you start your own family, right? Mm-hmm. And so how are you dealing with all of the trauma then? Are you still?
Well, so P.S. I check myself into a boarding school in North Carolina, 45 minutes from the farm. And I'm like, I'm not moving anymore. You guys do whatever you're going to do. I'm 18 at this moment.
When you went to the boarding school?
Sorry, that's when I, of course, graduated. No, I was 14, at the start.
Okay. But you needed some stability.
Well, I had never spent 1 year anywhere. I had never been in one school for like a full year, not one. So including kindergarten. We were never in one place. We tried everything. We tried, and I left out South Carolina and like a few other southern pit stops. But the reality is, by that time, I was just like, I need consistency. I want stability. I'm going to settle in. And I did, against my own truth. Like, that school didn't resonate for me, but I fought to stay there. And one of the people in the cafeteria also molested me at 17. And then my therapist did it. My therapist.
At the same age?
The same school, yeah. Special shout out to Dr. Travis, Asheville School. Uh-huh, did it to others too.
Oh.
So
that really came up later in the treatment center, my anger with these abusers that are in that position of trust.
Right.
That was infuriating.
Sure.
For a good reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whew. So, maybe this question is a bit premature, but when you look back at all of the times you've been assaulted, how do you account for that?
Like, how do I account of why it happened? How do you explain it
to yourself that this happened to you so many times as a child?
Well, I can explain it now in the depths of despair, as Anne of Green Gables would call it, and being truly taken to your knees and being, I mean, I've cried a lot of tears and I've had a lot of screaming into a lot of pillows and I've had a lot of processing. I am a woman that this happened for, to share light to the now. It happened for now. It happened for this. It happened for the movement I want to create. I want to co-create with the people that I believe are here to help me lead it. And I believe that everyone is part of this. And it's really that we're responsible for each other in terms of healing, because I had access to all of the support I needed to be where I am now, and not everybody does. And so it had to happen to this open vessel. I still am a very, very open vessel. And I know that people say, you know, if with someone that light, the dark can also come flood to, but I believe that it really did happen for me to be here.
But what about the lack of protection?
That was...
Because you had all kinds of opportunities to heal, but that's kind of, it's like after the fact.
Right.
I mean,
who was protecting me?
Yeah.
Well, the caregivers, that's a whole nother thing, came and went like bees to, what would you say? Flies to honey. I mean, bees to, what was the term? I don't know. But whatever it is, they came in and out a lot. And I never knew also, like, the caregiver we loved so much would be, like, fired in the night. And I wouldn't see them ever again. And I would never know what had happened except according to my mother. So I was devastated constantly. And I just feel like I was in fight or flight survival with an severe case of IBS and depression. I'm not saying I was thriving during these years.
Yeah, you would have to just shut yourself down after a while.
I stayed open to nature and to animals. Like, that was why the farm was like my most healing. And there weren't any years then at that period of time that I was being assaulted till I then went to high school again. But that was like a moment. I mean, I was angry about not being protected and I stuffed it into my digestion,
right,
or lack thereof.
Okay.
It was hard to digest all of that.
Yes.
You know? So I don't think I did really. And I think that I've had the time now to really move through it and process it with stability and support that's more grounded. But yeah, it was very unstable and not safe. And I was angry that I wasn't safe. But I've also been through a lot of forgiveness practices, knowing that the people that were taking care of me were doing the best they could at that moment with their life circumstances. And I understand and forgive, have forgiven big time over and over again, every single person, because if I don't, it's just eating me up. And I did that for a long time too. So and then also beyond that, I've learned that when your victim can become the creation, then it's always for you, not to you. And that's liberation, instead of feeling like a victim and feeling like this had happened to me for all, every single one of these things. Now I'm like, okay, let me talk about it. Let me share practices that have healed me. Let me financially give and support to mental health. Let me help whomever is open to hearing.
Right.
Have you, I mean, this is, it's so traumatic what you went through. And it's remarkable that you're able to forgive and help. My question is, have you like wrapped your arms around you,
yes,
the little girl?
So many times, okay. Justine. And that's because, again, I feel like I have, those are things you get to learn when you get practices that support you. I don't think I knew how to hold my little girl until this later woman also had to forgive herself too for like postpartum depression and not connecting instantly with my own children and processing things after, not, I couldn't then, right? So I was in it. It was triggering me. I didn't know what was going on. I was just surviving again and was probably my medication was wild and my hormones were nuts. But so I've had to spend many sessions with many healers, wrapping my arms, and I still do on a daily basis, loving her.
Yeah, good.
So that's huge.
Good.
And thank you for asking such a beautiful question.
Aww. Do you mind my asking how old you are?
I'm 38.
Okay. So between, I guess, the end of high school and 38, what has your life looked like?
The 20 years since. So I met my now former husband I met him at 16, and then a year and a half later, we started dating right before I was about to move to Italy, because I was doing this acting program, and I was like, maybe I'll just live there for a year, and I was the only undecided high school student at the Asheville school, and that was like crazy to them that I didn't know what I was doing.
Oh, okay.
So, which has a whole nother history of sexual abuse. The Asheville school, that's a whole nother chapter, which I would be very happy to talk about at some point, because that Southern, you know...
Yeah.
Decorum, and then right. What really is happening is unbelievable.
Wait a second, this is the boarding school
the boarding
that you went
school.
To?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. It is a wow. I'm telling you. It's a lot.
How has this not completely destroyed any faith that you might have in the world?
Because I'm a being of love.
So you've been able to hold on to it despite all of the times that you have been taken advantage of and used and all of that kind of stuff. Because, I mean... I've worked with people that have had way less sort of traumatic events happening over and over again that have completely lost any faith in humanity and, you know, the world around them, because that's one of the main things that goes when you're...
I think the faith is the thing that kept me alive.
Okay. That's a good thing. It's good for people to know what kept you alive.
I mean... Again, back to like the meditating outside and just being with nature and the garden and praying to the flowers or singing or knowing that I had a voice with them, you know, like I was really connected and I still am really connected. I walk around barefoot all the time, just connecting with nature. And I really, you know, have this sort of, you know, which we can address too, but like I had sort of also this label and this title of being, you know, the father of this well-known art dealer and this prestigious life and sort of a label of being rich and kind and pretty and all these things that are supposed to be good. And yet those were the things that kept bringing me down with all the people in my life, because they didn't, you shouldn't be all those things. And now I was lonely and didn't have friends. And it's like, faith had to, like, I believed in a higher thing that was actually creating this. That's what I didn't know it at the time. I couldn't explain it. I prayed every day. I had expressive tools that helped me. I danced it out of my body. I moved through things. I mean, that's a whole nother thing connected to the website, but like I have these tools that have helped me. And you're right. Like it's, if you look at the story of what we just shared, it's not only a lot, it's an overwhelming amount of what happened to a young being. Yeah. And I know that's me, but I also feel like I'm this vessel that was put here to have had that experience happen so that I could bring in a different message around it, which I would love to share where that I feel like I'm going with it, but we'll get there.
Okay. So you mentioned that you were married, but not.
I'm not married now.
Okay. Are you comfortable talking about what that experience was like?
Sure.
Yeah. And I feel like that is sort of when things started shifting once you had your own family.
Yeah. I think Daniel and I met and really found deep connection and found almost like a contract that we didn't know at the time was about also having these beautiful children. We have two children together and they're 7 and 10 now. And I feel so blessed that Daniel gave me not only these babies, but a family of that was his, that was very secure and stable and grounding for me. They were like, we went every Wednesday to watch Lost and eat, you know, the same sort of thing. I could find my same peanut butter chocolate treat at the end, like consistency. He gave me stability. He gave me safety. And that is, he did protect me like to the core and adored me and took care of me in ways that I'd never known. I love him eternally, and now he's remarried, and I love his wife, and he has a 7-month-old, and I love his baby and their baby, and she's an amazing mother, and she's amazing to my children, and I have nothing but the highest to say about them.
Why do you think the marriage came to an end?
I think we truly grew up together, and we grew into our own, who we needed and wanted to be at the next chapter, and I had never been with anybody else, really. I'd never explored the world. I'd never really, in terms of on my own, I'd been taken around, but I hadn't traveled. I hadn't had my own adventures. We were raising a family. We did a few things as much as we could here and there, but it wasn't my own. Like, I never was a teenager. I never was a child. I was always straight to an adult and adulting myself and adulting all those around me. And so I feel like we just grew to a place too after I had 2 postpartum, like really severe postpartum with both babies.
Okay.
And he was fantastic through it, but I had no confidence in myself as a mother. And I mean, we can talk about this too, but like I had no interest in pleasure. I was so shut off. And I know that's also deeply connected to where I was sexually. And it was actually Watsu, this water treatment of being held in the water, that started to open things in me. Like really, I felt safe, held, but that's like, but what's next? Like, that's great. But like the beautiful orange you're wearing today, Justine, it's like that creative sexual energy I had not known or ignited yet. And I think I needed to do that in my own way. And so we explored what felt like, you know, really powerful to set each other free, what that would feel like. And we did it as consciously and lovingly as we could. It was still deeply painful because it felt like the loss that I would never have. I felt like I cried for years and ended up having a really beautiful 4-year partnership with someone that was really empowering in my life too, after the fact, that I loved very much and will always love. And, you know, as I continue onward with other relationships, I'm just grateful for every single angel that came. And I feel like though that I can't, I was on some level hiding in safety and not exploring and expressing the wholeness of who I was.
Okay.
So that's what I really feel. And we just grew into our own thing. He became this amazing therapist, and we were separated. He met his wife in therapy school. She's an amazing therapist. It just, we're both kind of off helping people in a different way, but we're still a family. So it's powerful. And And that was the marriage chapter. I was 18 when we really started dating, and we divorced. I think it was like 5 years ago, 33.
And not to switch gears, but a little bit, because I want to talk about this too, is I know that there was a point in your life where your family and friends, and I think it's somewhere in that time period, your family and friends had a bit of an intervention with you. Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk to us about that a little bit? Because that's...
I would love to. So right before Daniel and Andrea got married, and I was super happy for them all along, but I got to this moment where I was like, I'm done being held back by my medicine. I'm tired of Prozac running, you know. I'm happy now. I'm happy. I'm in a relationship. I have great relationship with my kids. I'm traveling. I'm having my own life. Like, I'm good. I'm writing a script. I'm happy. So I'm going to wean off. And I talked to my doctor, and they talked about very, you know, maybe hesitant about it. And maybe you want to wait till after he gets married. And, you know,
how long had you been on the medicine?
Off and on since I was 12.
Okay.
So, when I would go off, I would have like 2 weeks depression bed. This would happen while we were married. He would, you know, we would finally call the doctor, and I would get back on.
And you would go off because you were like, I'm fine.
I'm fine. And also because, well, this time too, all my women that I was super close with were starting to do like plant-based ceremonies, and you can't do that if you're on antidepressants.
Right.
And I was like, I'm much more spiritual than I am like tied to Western medicine. I'm just going to do it. And so these women were, and they always saw me in ceremony. Like, they always felt me there. So I was like, oh, I'm just easy peas. I'm just going to get off of it. Maybe try some other plant medicines in between to help me along the way. And I've heard, you know, all these different other options are great. And I'm just going to like try doing it.
Sure.
And I did. I tried. I tried really hard, and I stayed really true to it. Like, I was like, I'm doing this. But by the time they got married, I had a breakdown, full-on breakdown, where I went, the women in my life that loved me so much to like throw me a little, I don't want to call it like wedding day ceremony, but sort of just to commiserate with me, or to support me and to honor me. And I was...
On the same day he was getting married?
They were there to support me. And that was the day of like my...
That would be the day, maybe.
Lose it off the radar. I mean, that's when the four women were above me, and I was in the bathtub, and they're like, what medicine are you on and what aren't you on? And like, what, we need to call a doctor. So I remember being in this bathtub at a dear friend's house in LA, who actually designed my house. And I was just surrounded by these powerful women that I'd met 15 years ago and that I trusted with my life.
Sure.
And, they're kind of my red lipstick tribe. They all were wearing red lips the day I met them. And I was just like, okay, these women can do anything. They're just like ready. And they were all there saying, we got you, but we got to get you somewhere. They didn't say it in that moment, but I could see the fear in their eyes. And I was manic. I mean, if you want to label it, you know. And what I was resisting was that we didn't talk about this much, but we can at some other point share the way I've sort of always operated as also a channel, you know, for spirit to come through, specifically Madame Gonawalska at Lotus Land. That's a very dear connection for me. And so I would open up my vessel without this medicine and be like, through the night, just write all these things, and I wouldn't be able to sleep. And I was like, these messages are coming so fast now, I can just like receive them. And I felt held back by people saying, slow down, or, you know, you're operating at a different frequency. I was like on another planet, and one of my best friend was like, are you leaving the planet? Like, where you're really like, are you going to ascend? I mean, if that's right, what you're going to do, like, we all love you and we get it. We know you're like live up there, but we got to get you grounded here if you want to stay here. Like,
so you went into a hospital environment?
So my friends found this center in Malibu, and I was gone for 6 weeks very shortly after. I was October a couple of years ago.
Did you feel like that was the right move at that point?
At that time, they suggested it. I sat with it. I really was scared of medicine. I really didn't want to be put on anything else. I was scared of what was next and what they were going to do. So I was terrified, but I knew it was the right thing in that I knew I wasn't okay. I felt I had been telling everybody I'm fine, but I would yell. I was so passionate and it was starting to scare my son even. And I was like, okay, this is not okay. If I'm like so passionate that I'm like ready to fly off and he's scared, it's like, that's not going to fly. So I was like, okay, they're right. And PS at that moment too, I was diagnosed with bipolar before I went because I saw a psychiatrist that was like, you really need to get on other medicine. We need to get you stable. We need to ground you. And I was like, no. And then it was about a month later that I was like, okay. And I had the resources to stay somewhere really nice. And that was this center in Malibu. And, you know, there was some major issues with it. I would not say it was the right move for my soul at the time. I felt pinpointed, labeled, destroyed. I actually felt like people were trying to hold me back from my truest self, which was channeling these messages, being connected, you know, but I mean, they would fly these messages from the sky and I was all a swirl. And when I got, it was pure fear for me. I would remember getting in this room and having this, like, these people come to evaluate, and I was in so much physical pain. I the weaning of the medicine, I guess there was something about it though that, like, I felt like I wasn't getting most of what I needed. I was getting trying different meds, best doctor in the world. She was amazing. I had the best therapist that wrote the, you know, victim to creator on the dry erase board, which is like full circle back to my 6-year-old self where I'm recreating. She was epic. I loved this therapist. I went for her. She was life changing for me. And I also went to connect with the souls that I met and found that also were swimming upstream and really needed support. And I mean, while I was there, you know, someone died. While I was there, I witnessed a young girl who had been raped by one of the people that were there. And I witnessed some scary shit. Rats were in the sofas jumping out at people. What was going on at the top rehab center? And I would every week run into the director with a manifesto of all the things that needed to be shifted. I wanted a gardening class where we could put our hands in the earth. I wanted not styrofoam cups for juices.
Let's get rid of the rats.
Well, that was my first. I have a great friend here that we call Steve the Rat Man. He calls himself Ratty. And I was like, I need you. Like, and then I'm like, I need you to come. And they wouldn't, like, I don't know if they, what happened there, but it was intense. And I remember even things like beautiful art being on the walls, things like that. Like, I saw what a healing center could be. And I saw that, like, a big grand space of it, if you're not serving holistic foods and your body is a wreck, isn't going to help you.
Right.
And I saw that a massage, when you're in fight or flight on that level, like once a week, isn't going to do it when you're in that much pain. And a couple of Tylenol, when you're used to self-medicating in other ways, is not going to do it. Right. So I was angry, like I've never been angry at my life for feeling not taken care of in a place that's supposed to do nothing but take care of you. And they did the best that they could in the way that they could, just like my parents or my child carers.
It doesn't sound to me like they did. I mean, that's what their business is. And it doesn't sound like they were taking care of anyone.
I mean, that's definitely how I felt at the time. And I'm still having residual anger around it, no question. But I also see that in their minds, they were doing, like, I would come in and say all this, and then they would try to do a little improvement, and they would say they did this. And I was ballistically angry.
So when you left, did you feel like you were better, or did you, I would probably still be angry.
I felt worse when I left. Yeah. So I wasn't on the right dose of medicine, and it was actually a healer that saw me and energetically, because all I did was cry. When I came home, it was like my little 12-year-old fetal position girl. I just cried all day, every day.
And this was just a few years ago.
Yeah.
So since that time to now, I mean, you seem like you seem fine to me. You don't say that. I would never have looked at you as being somebody who was bipolar.
Thank you.
You don't have that energy at all.
What it Most feels of like, my friends don't think that I am.
Do you think you are?
The question of bipolar was really interesting, and I wrote a lot about it because I wrote about poles. Like, am I from the North Pole? Am I from the South Pole? Am I from the East Pole or the West Pole? What does this even mean? Because all of a sudden now I went from depressed to bipolar, and these labels that are put upon people, and all of a sudden they tell you that you're this, but that's not who you are. And I couldn't grapple with it. I couldn't understand it. My aunt was bipolar, and I learned that when I was there. On both sides, there's that label in the families. But
do you mind if I interrupt just for a second and ask you to think about something?
Oh, I'd be.
I can't tell you how many people have been referred to me by the psychiatric community as being diagnosed with bipolar. And when I meet the person, it's very puzzling to me because it's so clear to me that the person is suffering from really severe post-traumatic stress.
Exactly.
And that it masquerades itself in many different ways.
Yep.
Because the whole basis of it is trying to cope with trauma that's so far beyond anything a person should ever have to deal with. And the kind of anxiety and disconnection from yourself that it can create can make it seem like there's something really wrong with you.
Yeah.
And then you end up going into the medical community of people that, you know, give you all these drugs and this and that. And and most of the time, the people that I've worked with that have dealt with the trauma, they're off their medicine and it's not even an issue anymore because it never was in the first place. Because we're so quick to be frightened by people that appear to be out of control. And we want to make that person okay so that we don't have to be scared in relationship to them.
My God, talk about healing. Thank you so much.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to consider because, I'm thinking this woman sure doesn't seem bipolar to me.
Because I mean, I'll tell you the medicine I'm on. I'm very open about all of it. I take lithium at night, but a very small dose. Okay. And they upped my Prozac was at 10 milligrams when I got out of this institute. And then the healer was like, I think you need to up it by another 10. And I just went to 20. Before I took 40.
Okay.
So I'm just giving you and then, you know, lithium, I think I'm at 600 or something, but you can go way up.
Well, again, I'm not a psychiatrist. So as far as the medicine goes, I understand that that's how bipolar is treated. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's a little bit unusual to not have like incredible manic episodes when you take drugs like Prozac.
I know.
Because that's how they diagnose bipolar illness, is to give people those antidepressants, and then that triggers a manic episode.
That's what they told me when they said I was bipolar, is that I had to get off the Prozac because it would be triggering the manic episode. But they gave me the lithium, I guess, to balance it out and kept me on it. That was like the addition. But in addition to that, like, I just, so you know, like, that was the big thing, was I was taking every holistic support that I could, masseuse, every acupuncturist, every healing, every sound healing, every cacao ceremony.
Okay.
I can't even tell you how many I've done of all of those things. None of the ayahuasca or any of that because I couldn't on the medicine, but I'm actually a partner in Palma, which is a healing center now here in Santa Barbara. So there's been a lot of beauty that's come from, you know, my learning about all of these different healing modalities, because I felt the same way. I was like, I'm not bipolar and this isn't enough to give me Prozac. I'm just angry as hell and I deserve to be, because you have rats jumping around here. And one of the girls just had to come back because one of the other patients raped her. And like, I'm furious and somebody just died. And, you know, you're not letting people in to see me at the certain hours and I'm devastated. I'm away from my kids. I'm like, of course I'm furious. Yeah. Plus I just got off my medicine,
but there's another issue to sort of consider, and that's that all of the treatment that you received as a child can only help you to the degree of emotional maturity that you possess at that time.
Mm.
Because until you go through puberty, your mind is not capable of three-dimensional thought. Kids are all black and white. And it's not because there's something wrong with them. It's that when we go through puberty, our brain develops the third dimension in terms of being able to see things so differently. And that's why adolescents think they know everything, because compared to what they were like before they went through puberty, they do know everything.
Oh.
And so I've known lots of people that have been, you know, horribly abused as kids, and they did get help. But it can only help to the level of your ability to process what's happening. And so usually the post-traumatic stress stays with you until you're a young adult or in your 20s, because it's only then that you have the ability to really deal with it on a deeper level.
Exactly.
If that makes sense.
Complete sense.
Okay. So again, maybe you already know all this stuff.
No, it's brilliant. And it's absolutely fascinating, because that's sort of what I felt intuitively, was like, this is the first time I've been able to really deal with this stuff. Right. And the other thing I had to deal with is that I was like, this is a whole nother thing, but like my resentment around money, my energy around control, around having it or feeling like I don't, or feeling like I do, but I can't access what I want to do, or all of these things about trust and money and coming from that, but not feeling secure in it really. It was like all of that just hit me while I was going through like how I treated other people in regards to it, how I might have not been my kindest at moments based on how I was dealing with my trauma. So I was really grieving my own abandonment of like my truest self of in terms of how I was being, how I was relating to other people around me while I was in so much pain.
Right.
Because I'm nothing but intending to be loving and kind. And I had made mistakes and screwed up and had to really sit with it and apologize for it and go in and like look at, to hold myself accountable. And that was really hard. But I also forgave myself based on all the, you know, the trauma and all the things that had gone on. So I've been in a process of all of that. And, but no, it's very healing what you're saying to me about the bipolar versus the post-trauma stress, because it just, it's landing in a way that's really nourishing.
Well, I'm sure Dana agrees, is you're such a sensitive being. And to have all of this stuff happen to you from 18 months on, like that's going to affect you deeply.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing that you haven't spontaneously combusted.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to make light of your situation.
That was my moment though. That October breakdown I almost did spontaneously combust. My whole body was shaking. The question if it's bipolar or the post-trauma or the meds or the whatever that is, be a fascinating to learn more. And it's very valuable, everything you said. But what I do know is that I had a breaking point and I needed help. And I couldn't do anything else.
We all do, my friend.
I know. And it was really the place to break through. But what I also did during that healing center time, which wasn't as healing in some ways that I had wanted, was I really took notes as to what is needed during healing. And I got to really be in that place from that perspective and witnessed it, and witnessed doing like sound bowls and new moon manifestations and for the clients there, that the other patients with them, and dreaming big and writing. I wrote so much, and I found all these tools and ultimately created this website that is based, my journey through the chakras is really the story that we've shared. But I had to kind of organize it in some way. And one of my biggest things was feeling limited, like being defined as bipolar, or even as a child being defined by like, well, that's her favorite color. You know, you can have this one favorite color. And that's why I love full circle back to your color wheel. It's like, I really want to encompass for everyone around me, anything I represent for all. Like I want healing for all. I want everyone to feel like they could say rainbow is their favorite color, or to not even answer the question if they don't want to be defined that day. Like whatever it is it's such an honor to have gone through, because my biggest like moment at Avalon, I'll never forget it, was I was on the floor. Like I was truly taken to my knees and I was in so much pain and I lived for this like bath and I was out of bath bombs and I was just like, had gotten a picture. The kids had gotten a new puppy and I was just like not there and devastated and everyone was moving on and all my dearest friends were trying to give me space to not talk to me, but I felt so alone. And I got on the floor and I was like crawling, sobbing, just crawling, sobbing. And I got on my knees and I was like, okay, God, this has to be for something. Like, I don't know what, but I am living on a thread right now in a prayer that this amount of pain is at the other side of the rainbow, is that big pot of gold for everyone else to receive, because I should not have to hold this as one vessel in the world without it being in service. Okay. I want to release it and I want to serve. So please help me learn how to do that.
So what you're saying now is incredibly important. It's about at the end of this particular hour.
Yes.
But if it's okay with you, I would love to continue the conversation for another hour at another time.
100%. We've already discussed.
Because this would be like, chapter one. If you know
I
what
know.
I mean. Because I feel like there's lots more for us to talk about in terms of what you've dedicated your life to. And,
thank you.
And what you're doing moving forward and how it all works. And we don't have the time right now to do that. So if it's okay, I would really honored. Love
I can't wait.
Help Belle come back and do.
Belle is coming back. I'm already here. I'm already there for the next round. I mean, what would be fun too at some point, the way I was designing, the way the website, I'll just share this last thing. The way the website came about was like, how do I organize this as a book? My life, through the chapters. And right. So I started with chapter red, like the grounding, the chakra, uh-huh. the blood, like the trauma, and then the transcendence or the integration of it.
Right.
And then even into the beauty of it, like maybe the red blood is very triggering, but the red lip is like, this is my empowerment. This hasn't taken my power. This has become my power.
Right.
And so that's where this transformation of through the rainbow, through these chapters or chakras would be really fun to share some tools too. And very excited. So my website in the meantime is bellhahn.com. And I just added 50 plus tools, like different modalities.
Okay.
So those just went live the other day.
Oh, great.
And there will be more coming in. So there will be an unlimited supply of support is what I want to offer. So,
okay. Well, I don't want to say goodbye because I want you to come back.
Farewell.
If that's
thank
fair.
Thank you, doctor.
Because I really believe that we're in a certain way just getting started.
We are.
And I think that what you have to offer is extremely important for people to sort of understand. I mean, if you listen to other episodes of the podcast, we've had a lot of people come talk about their trauma, because I want to, you know, get the world to understand that it's, no matter what happens, generally speaking, you can, if you're willing to fight hard enough to heal, you can get there.
I agree.
It takes an enormous amount of courage.
And a lot of work. There were a lot of days where all I did was cry.
Yeah.
People, the other thing that's like really powerful for me to be talking about it through this lens is if you pop onto my Instagram or if you see me in the paper or whatever, Bell of the Ball, it's like, I've got a new ball rolling and I'm on this like really exciting trajectory for healing. And I want to use all of that, whatever it is called, like social energy or, you know, transforming the social light to spreading light to the social. I'm ready to really use whatever I can offer for the highest good for healing and for freedom.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the podcast
today.
And, you gave your information, but if anybody wants to reach out to me for our next episode in talking with you, if they have questions, to reach out to me.
We'll put your website in the show notes too, so people can reach you.
So much. What a treasure for me to, it's also very healing to talk.
It sure is.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.